Les séminaires du Collège de France.
It's really a real pleasure to see Monica Edelsberger today here. So I will say a few words to introduce Monica, although I'm sure many of you know her very well. So Monica is a professor at the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich. She's also, I don't know, what is the official title, research group leader?
Yes.
At Max Planck? This is how it is called?
That's okay. How it's called.
For the moment.
The official title.
Okay. So Monica made her PhD under the supervision of Emmanuel Bloch. I think you defended in 2015. That was a wonderful PhD thesis with many things. I will say some of the subjects she covered, but it was really impressive. And then we were lucky enough to welcome her for a postdoc here in Paris. And then she went back to Munich, unfortunately. So, yes, Monica has worked on many different subjects. So, for thesis and then later, so I've listed a few of them. The realization of the Hofstadter Hamiltonian, famous Hofstadter butterfly. The measurement of the Zach phase in a 1D gas, the measurement of a Chern number in a 2D gas, the realization of a Thouless pump, and more recently, the realization of anomalous Floquet system, which was a very nice achievement. Simulation of gauge theory, this is what we'll hear today. Not gauge theory?
Well,
quantum simulation. In
yes.
Case,
but, okay. Maybe I can say a little bit in the end, but we'll
okay.
See.
As you want. She has also received many awards. I'm not going to list all of them. Let me just mention the Junior BEC Award. It was in 23, I think. Yes, something like that. Yes, 23. And also, you are a member of ACATEC, which is the German Academy of Science and Technology. This is what it is. It's a nice name.
Yes.
It sounds a bit Mexican, you know, ACATEC.
It's to advise politicians, you know. Well, we'll try.
Okay, so thank you very much for coming, Monica, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this very nice and kind introduction. I'm always happy to be back in Paris. It still feels very familiar. It still feels a bit like coming home, so I enjoy it very much. I also enjoyed very much my time here as a postdoc. And it's kind of about gauge theories, but not dynamical gauge theories, but recent tools that we have developed in order to study many-body phases in the presence of artificial magnetic fields. So it connects a little bit to tools that we developed for studying the Hofstadter model, and where basically I'm trying to give you a sense of what we can do now to observe these phases and how we can try to scale them up to actually have many strongly interacting particles in that system. But before I start, all of what I'm going to present will be basically about these pictures. Why we work with these systems, what we can do, and how we manipulate them. And so what we are working with is neutral atoms in optical lattices. So this is what you see here. Essentially, all these little dots are individual atoms, cesium atoms, that are arranged in a square optical lattice. And this is also why I picked this title, Atom by Atom, because what we are really trying to do is assemble a many-body system where we can control the microscopic interactions between particles, and we can see and manipulate, in principle, each individual atom. So this is the main starting point, and it's a little bit hard to see on that picture, but essentially we trap the atoms in addition in a box. So you should think about these particles as arranged in a square lattice geometry, but in addition they are like sharp walls at the edges, so it's like a container, and at the bottom we have this nice optical lattice potential. Okay, so before I start talking about more details of this experimental platform, I wanted to zoom out a little bit and remind you what we are all excited about these days, or at least many of us. And there's a lot of discussion in the news and everywhere about quantum technologies and hopes and dreams, but also new technologies that are already available today. And quantum systems have applications potentially across many variety, a large variety of areas. There are quantum sensing applications. applications in quantum communication. And then the ultimate goal that you hear often in the news is about developing quantum computation and having fault-tolerant quantum computational devices that then can implement any algorithm that we'd like. And the key new addition to all of this, and why we believe there are so many new technologies, is that we can now control not only individual quantum particles, as you know we can already do for a while, there have been Nobel Prizes awarded to this, but now the idea is to really make use of the interaction between them, engineer them in a very precise way, and have a large interacting many-body system. And then the idea would be that the structure, like entanglement in the state, can be used for something interesting, like sensing applications, for instance. That's the ultimate goal that I think now is shared across all of these applications. We are trying to understand that, and then also for material science, maybe find new many-body phases of matter that can have interesting applications. And all of this is somehow rooted in this idea that we know that a quantum many-body system can store a lot of information. It's inherently complex, so if we can manage and leverage this complexity, of course, then we can try to control it and build new devices. And I'm sure you have now seen this in some form or the other. I just want to remind you again about why this complexity, or what we mean by that, like where does it come from, and why is it so challenging to control, but also so promising. And the easiest way to see this is just to think about how we describe a system of many interacting quantum particles. And so first of all, we could try to understand like how do we write down the state of such a system. Okay, and now if we think about spin 1/2 particles, they can be either in up or down. The spin could be pointing, like here illustrated in red, up, or they could be all pointing down. But each individual spin has that degree of freedom. So I can have all other different combinations as well, all other different configurations. So if I start counting how many I can get, well, then it can start on side one, so it's either up or down, that's two. Then I can add another one. It can also be either up or down. So if I count all of the configuration, it's four of them. It's two to the power of two. And now we can continue going on and on and on. If I add a third one, it's eight. So I double it every time I add another spin. Okay, so that means at the end, the space, or the number of configurations, grows exponentially with the number of spins that I have in my problem. But now, if I want to actually describe a quantum many-body system, I have to write down a quantum mechanical wave function that is in a superposition of all of these configurations, in principle. Like, if I don't have any other knowledge about the state, then I need all of these coefficients. And this is illustrated here, so there are these coefficients Cn in front of these configurations, and I have 2 to the power of n. Okay? So now, if I want to store such a state in my computer, I can count how many coefficients I need to store in the memory of my computer. If I have 10, it's 1,000. If I go to 20, then I have already a million. If I go to 40, well, that's already a fairly large number. And if I go to 300, it's 10 to the 90. And even supercomputers then fail to store the state and do computations with it. So I've only talked about just even writing down the state and storing it in the memory of your computer. And I guess we can all agree that 300 is not very many atoms. If you try to understand the properties of a material, like 300 electrons is not, it's not very much, right? So we would like to do more. Now, that just tells you that if I don't have any other knowledge about my system, this is what I need to do. So if I want to do some brute force simulation of the dynamics, for instance, of a quantum many-body system or the properties, and I have no additional approximations, that's what I will have to do. Now, this is incredibly challenging, and that limits our ability to learn what the properties of a quantum system are, what they can be, and, of course, that's the starting point of even trying to develop new technologies based on that. And now, quantum simulation goes back to the idea of Richard Feynman, then, that if we cannot do that, well, maybe there are other ways of learning more about a quantum many-body system or controlling a quantum many-body system if we go ahead and build such a device in the lab. So the dream would be, well, I can take my spin 1/2 particles, I know how to control them individually, and now if I can assemble in a programmable way a large many-body system, I can perform measurements on it, I can control externally the parameters between them, and learn how the system works. And then, you know, there are many applications or many regimes where we can find, hopefully, efficient approximations and describe the properties of these systems. And then there may be other regimes where we just cannot efficiently approximate it. And this is then what you hear in the news about quantum advantage and going beyond what we can do classically. This would be the parameter space where we maybe just cannot approximate how the quantum many-body system behaves. But building such a device in the lab fundamentally gives us the opportunity to learn and explore this space of quantum many-body systems. And now this is a very limited selection of pictures. There's just no way I can put all platforms and all groups that work on this topic on one slide. But to give you some of the main examples of platforms where people try to implement these types of ideas based on quantum simulation is superconducting qubits, trapped ions, Rydberg atom arrays, and I will talk about neutral atoms and optical lattices. There are also photonic platforms, semiconductor devices. There's a lot of beautiful physics now with 2D materials and actual solid state systems. So there's a large variety and many different facets of this topic. And the ones I selected here, I also selected because you can see, or maybe some of you have heard about this, that these devices are also used to develop quantum computation in the experiment or in the lab. And what we see a lot today is that there's like these distinctions blur. Like you have on the one hand analog quantum simulation devices where you implement the microscopic interaction, and on the other hand, a computation device where you really try to program in a gate-based way the interactions between the particles. The platform I'm going to talk about today is this one, and I will give you a very brief nutshell overview of how these systems work or how you should think about them, and then I would like to give you an introduction into some of the new tools that we have developed in order to study topological phases of matter. And so in a very pictorial way, what we do is we trap neutral atoms in periodic potentials that we generate by interfering laser beams. So this periodic potential that you see here essentially is generated by interfering two counterpropagating laser beams, and then we get fringes of bright and dark regions of light. And for the atoms, this shows up as a potential energy landscape. And before we load the atoms into this potential, we form, in this case, a Bose-Einstein condensate. So we go to very, very low temperatures in the nano-Kelvin regime, and then we adiabatically load them into this optical potential. Now, because we generate it by interfering laser beams, the neighboring distance is on the order of the wavelength of the light that we use to form that potential. So typically, that's on the order of half a micrometer. So depending on from where you come from, this is either very small or very large. If you have an actual condensed matter system in mind where this would be angstrom, it's extremely large. If you're thinking about Rydberg atom arrays that are used for computation, this distance is rather small because there they work at many micrometer distances. So now if we load the atoms into such a potential at very low temperatures, the dynamics is very simple. You have seen just in the lecture before, Josephson tunneling equations. And all we do is essentially have atoms that can tunnel through this barrier. So if you think about a single particle, it can move around as a probability for hopping between neighboring sites across this potential barrier. And this is given by the amplitude J. That would be our kinetic energy term. And now if we have more than one particle, or if they are interacting, then whenever they meet on the same site, there is an interaction energy term that we have to take into account as well. And this can either be positive or negative, so it can be either repulsive or attractive in the system. And then the basic Hamiltonian or equations that describe the dynamics of that system can be expressed in this form, where A and A dagger are creation and annihilation operators. So A dagger A just means I destroy a particle on site J and create it on site I. So this is the hopping term, the kinetic energy term. And this interaction energy term counts how many particles I have on one specific lattice site I. So n is the number operator that just counts how many particles I have there. So this is the nonlinear term. And now you might say, well, this Hamiltonian looks extremely simple. I have two terms, j and u. So how interesting can this potentially get? And I think this is the beauty of these quantum many-body systems. The properties of this Hamiltonian, if you add potential energy terms and so on, is surprisingly rich. So there's a lot of exciting physics that we can study. And if you think about putting fermions in such a system, you add a spin degree of freedom and you pick fermions, you get the Fermi-Hubbard model. And despite the fact that there are only two parameters, we still don't know how the phase diagram of the Fermi-Hubbard model looks like. And I think this is maybe a very nice example on trying to see or appreciate why quantum many-body problems are so difficult to address. Okay, and now, so this is the simplest form. I just have here a few examples on how to make this model even more complicated. So you can think about having more long-range interactions, not just on a single side, extended Hubbard models, putting atoms with dipolar interactions. So there are a lot of different ways to make this system even more complicated than I put here on the slide. Okay, so let me say a few words about how the science chamber or the experimental system looks like and how we get these pictures. So there's a whole range of cooling steps before, but then the final experimental chamber or the final science happens in this glass cell. So this schematic shows a glass cell where we have 11 side ports. These are these little windows over here. We have a top and a bottom window. This glass cell is very tiny. To give you a sense of the scale, the distance between this top and bottom window is a centimeter. Okay, so it's an extremely tiny region where we manipulate the atoms, and they are located in the center of the cell. From the side, we shine in these counterpropagating laser beams to create the interfering potentials. And out of plane, we confine them by another standing wave or vertical lattice. So we have 2D physics in that system. And in order to see the atoms, we build high NA imaging systems. So it's really a microscope that we build around the glass cell in order to be able to see each individual atom. And since the distance between neighboring sites is extremely small, we want to get very, very close with our optical lenses to have a high optical resolution. And that's also why the distance between the top and the bottom window is so small. So in our case, the distance is 380 nanometer, which is extremely tiny. Okay, now how you should think about these types of experiments is that we prepare the atoms in this two-dimensional potential. Then we perform a quantum simulation experiment. So we have this quantum many-body wave function psi. And then in order to observe the atoms, we make this optical lattice potential extremely deep, such that the atoms cannot move anymore. We freeze the motion. And then we scatter near-resonant photons that we then collect with this high NA imaging objective to generate these types of pictures. And that's actually a relatively complicated process, or to engineer the parameters right, because scattering photons from the atoms gives the atoms like a little recoil kick. Like every time the atom absorbs or emits a photon, it gets like a little kick. That means eventually the atoms heat up, they gain energy. And so we need to make the potential deep enough so that the atoms don't fall out of the trap or even start to hop to a different site. And what that means in our case is that we need to do scattering and cooling at the same time. And then the steady state of the cooling that you can apply should be, steady state temperatures should be small compared to the trap depth. And in our case, this is about 250 microkelvin in trap depth that we need to achieve. And then we collect photons on a camera, so we really take pictures of the atoms. And here what you see is that each individual dot, this corresponds to about 3,000 photons per atom that we collect on a camera. Okay, so now we have these pictures. That's great. So the question is, what can we learn from these pictures about our many-body system? And now I've written down the many-body wave function in a slightly different form compared to the different spins that we had before. Now it's written in occupation basis, meaning that each individual dot here represents one lattice site, which is either occupied or empty. And After the quantum simulation experiment, the many-body wave function is a superposition in a superposition of all of these configurations. And so what happens if I take a picture is I project this wave function onto one of these configurations. Okay, so after I've taken one snapshot, I have not really learned very much about my system, other than I can maybe count the total number of particles. So in order to learn anything about my quantum many-body system, I need to repeat the measurement many times. And we usually call this a sampling from this many-body wave function. So every time I repeat the measurement, I project it onto a different configuration. And then I can, for instance, evaluate the probabilities, the absolute value of C0 squared, of finding that configuration. And so if you're thinking about the system, this is actually fairly large. So typically this box is about 50 by 50 lattice sites. So these are a lot of particles. We can go to a regime where we work with like 2,000 particles. This is already beyond what you can compute with brute force techniques classically on a computer. And now you can try to extract as much information from these pictures as you can. And there's, of course, more than just evaluating these amplitudes. The simplest is to evaluate mean occupations from these pictures, but you can also evaluate density-density correlation functions or particle number fluctuations in a certain subregion of the system, and all of this will give you complementary information about this wave function that you have prepared. I should also say that I'm very happy if you interrupt me and want to ask questions at any time during this presentation so that I get a sense of what you would like to know more details about. So please don't hesitate to just raise your hand and ask something. All right. So now this is the basic starting point. So that's essentially the introduction of the platform. And now I want to spend one more slide putting it into the bigger perspective where I see these systems at the moment. And so I've put this on a graph, essentially. So on the left, you see what we will be talking about today, which is analog quantum simulation, where I said that we engineer the microscopic interactions between the particles. So we simulate this Hamiltonian H. And then, for instance, we can look at time evolution. And what is great about these systems is that we can make them fairly large. So we work with a few thousand particles. And typically, they have rather long coherence times. So there's a lot of physics that we can study with those. And then the main question is really like, what types of interactions can we access? What types of Hamiltonians can we engineer? And then all the way on the other side is universal quantum computing, where everything is about control and programmability. Where I've picked this schematic, which is gate-based computation, where we build any dynamics or any Hamiltonian evolution and decompose it into single qubit and two qubit gates. So we have operations between two neighboring particles, for instance, in that system. And here the main task really is to make it fault tolerant. That means every operation that we apply, every manipulation that we want to implement comes with a tiny little error. And even if it's on the order of 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 5, it builds up. Like you have to implement many, many million gates. And in order to correct for these, we need to develop tools for error correction in these systems. And so we are not quite there yet. So I think an interesting question also is, like, what can we do maybe in the meantime before we have these fault-tolerant quantum computing devices? And I think what is very exciting is that we can pick these synthetic quantum systems, which I would argue are already 2D materials in their own right. So they're very interesting properties that we can study and learn from. And what we can now work towards is sort of enhancing their capabilities. So it's not building a quantum computer, but we can add like little tools and ingredients to either have more, more programmability for the initial state or for reading it out, or in general, like more complicated protocols that can also lead us to develop new sensing protocols, for instance, that could be implemented in other systems as well. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Now, this was very abstract, but I can give you a very nice and hopefully intuitive example of what I mean by this. And so if you're thinking about this and I have like a little digital tools that I now interface with my analog quantum simulation device, The first thing that I can try to do is like nearest neighbor manipulations, just between two nearest neighbor atoms in my system. And the main question why we started doing this is, I've told you how we generate these snapshots, how we can learn information about the occupation, density correlators. But there's really no information about the phase or any other property of the system. If you're thinking about this 2D material, maybe you want to measure other quantities, like local currents, or maybe you want to learn something about the nearest neighbor phases in this system. And this is very difficult to extract if you just have information about where the particles sit. And so in order to get a little bit more information from our 2D system, we can add like an additional time evolution step before we take the picture, before we do the projective measurement. And this we do by modifying the optical potential. And we can modify the optical potential by changing the tunneling barrier between neighboring sites. If we make it very large, as illustrated here in this double well type potential, then the probability for an atom moving across that barrier is exponentially suppressed, which means we can essentially turn it off. So now what we can do is we can turn off the tunnel coupling along every other barrier along this 1D chain and along every bond in the perpendicular direction. And that means the only dynamics that happens is now between two sites. So I have my quantum many-body wave function, and then I just chop it into these dimer configurations. And now I can restrict the discussion of the ongoing time evolution to this two-site picture. Okay? So now two sites are nice because we can try to understand it on a Bloch sphere. So we label these states as left and right in this double well, but it could be spin up or spin down in a typical conventional two-level system. And now I have full control over the shape of this potential. So if I couple these two sites symmetrically, that's like the kinetic energy term that I mentioned previously in Hubbard language, but if I'm just thinking about two spins, it is a sigma x coupling, which I will show in a bit how to think about this in a pictorial way. If I apply an energy offset between these two sites, it is like a sigma z term in a two-level picture, or just a potential energy in the Hubbard language. So combined, the Hamiltonian looks like this. I have two terms, sigma x and sigma z, I can control the amplitude of each individual term, and I can also control the time during which this Hamiltonian acts on my system. And so now we can try to understand this on a Bloch sphere. So I put my two states on the poles. I have left pointing up and right pointing down. And in a very simple picture, what these Hamiltonian terms do is they rotate my state around that specific axis. So the surface of the sphere describes all my states for one particle in a system, a coherent superposition of left and right. If I have the particle localized on the left-hand side, it would be just a vector pointing up. And then if I apply my sigma x term, what it does, it keeps rotating the state around the x-axis. And if I apply my sigma z term, it does the same, but it rotates it around the sigma z axis. Okay, so now if I go back to my Hubbard language, the sigma z axis is density. So that's my usual measurement basis. So if I just look where do the particles sit in my lattice, I measure the expectation value of my density operator. If I look at the sigma x term, I already mentioned that's essentially kinetic energy. So if I go back to my Hubbard parameters, this is A dagger A, so it describes this hopping process from one side to the other. If I can rotate this into being my measurement basis, I can measure the expectation value of the kinetic energy term. And over here, the sigma y corresponds to the current operator in my system. Okay, so if I now want to actually measure currents in my optical lattice, what I want to do is, after finishing my quantum simulation, I want to have a little time step that is a pi over 2 rotation around x that rotates the current basis into my measurement basis. Then I take a picture and I can generate a local map of the current distribution in the optical lattice. And you can also implement all sorts of other protocols, like everything that you know from NMR or two-level systems, like Ramsey protocols, spin-echo protocols. All of this you can do just using these very simple operations and combining x and z operations. Okay, so we have tried this in a very simple system that we generate artificially, just to convince ourselves that that actually works. I will get back to this in a bit. For now, the only thing that is relevant is that we generate a tiny little lattice of four sites. We have an artificial magnetic field that I don't tell you for the moment how that works. But we have two strongly interacting particles in that system. And if you load them into the ground state of such a plaquette, due to the magnetic field, there's a chirality. So the ground state actually has these nice circulating currents around the edges of that plaquette. It's at half filling, so if you just measure occupations, you will not see anything. The particles just have a probability of 1/2 to be on each one of these four little sites. All the information is in these currents, which are illustrated by these little arrows over here. And one main motivation for doing this is to study topological phases of matter, and I will get to that in a bit. Okay, so what we have done is generate an array of these little plaquettes in our 2D system. Similar idea, we chop the 2D lattice into small plaquettes, and in each one of these plaquettes, we put two strongly interacting particles and prepare the ground state. And then we measure these local currents, and this is an actual measurement of the current distribution that we have essentially programmed by hand in such a system. So what you see here is a measurement of the current in these local bonds. So each one of these plaquettes, again, has two particles, and there's a flux pointing out of the plane. So each one has this chirality, and we measure the mean current. So you can see that, indeed, like between these nearest neighbors, there's a current pointing to the left on the lower bond, on the right in the upper bond, and so on to make a closed loop. And you can also see that because of finite statistics, some of them appear broken, like there's a missing link here, there's a missing link here. This is shot noise, this is actually due to finite statistics and averaging many, many of these experimental realizations. But this now is what we call like a local current microscope, which now gives you a completely different way of looking at your many-body system. So instead of just taking the snapshots and finding, okay, there's a homogeneous density, and I have generated an artificial magnetic field, so there should be probably something interesting, we can just directly look at other observables that are maybe better suited to give you relevant information about your system. No. Yeah, that's a very good question. So indeed, I should also say that this is a sequence of measurements, right? Because I'm grouping nearest neighbors. The neighboring bond I have to measure in a separate experimental realization. So this is actually decomposed over four different measurements. And indeed, it would be nice to have like coherencies between like this site and, let's say, I pick site six, if I want to. There are ideas, but it's a little bit challenging. Nathan had ideas on measuring, you know, more than one current operation in order to get more interesting information. So I think there are extensions to make this more general. They are a little bit more difficult, but not impossible. I should also say that the Bloch sphere that I explained was explained completely in a single particle picture. And this was done for interacting particles. At the end of the day, we want to be able to study many-body physics. So what you can do is turn the interaction off during these pictures. So we have the ability, using Feshbach resonances, to tune the Hubbard on-site interaction to zero while we implement these rotations. Okay, so now let me try to explain what we want to do in order to study topological phases of matter. Why this is interesting and how we realize these systems in the first place. And just to motivate why topology is interesting, I like to show this picture of a silicon MOSFET device because I think it's kind of, I'm trying to convince you that there are remarkable properties in the system which maybe at first doesn't look like a precision measurement tool. So what you see here is a Hall-Bar geometry. There's a two-dimensional electron gas. You can send a current through the sample, apply a perpendicular magnetic field, and measure longitudinal and transverse voltages. So we know that for charged particles, if there's a magnetic field, there's a Lorentz force, there's a Hall deflection, there's a Hall voltage that builds up. And in the classical regime, This is linear. So here's the magnetic flux density or the magnetic field applied perpendicular through the sample. And here's the transverse Hall resistance. And in a classical regime, there is this nice, beautiful linear relation, which is also used to calibrate the charge carrier density, things like this. This is very standard. But now what's the exciting physics about this as we go to the integer quantum Hall regime, very clean devices, very large magnetic fields, is that there's a deviation from this linear curve. And there are these nice plateaus that develop in the transverse Hall resistance. And what is remarkable about these plateaus is that they don't occur by accident. They are not due to specifics in the sample, like specific impurities, dislocations, or how I attach the leads, anything related to the dimensionality of this Hall bar geometry. You can repeat them, and you can repeat them with remarkable precision. And the main physical origin, or the main reason why they are so remarkably stable, is the topology of the energy bands that are occupied with electrons. And you can assign this very simple equation to compute the transverse Hall resistance, which is given by integer numbers, nu, that's the topological invariant characterizing the many-body phase, and natural constants, Planck's constant, and the charge of the electron. And that's all you need in order to describe the value of the plateau where you measure the transverse Hall resistance. And just to emphasize, this can be measured with a precision or uncertainty that is less than 1 part in 10 to the 10. And I think this is really remarkable, right? If you think about, you have such a system in the lab, a solid state device, you can perform this measurement. It's immediately clear that this is relevant for technological applications, or even just comparing different resistance measurements across labs around the world. And I think this is a good example or intuition why topology is of such a big interest and has led to the redefinition of the SI units in 2019. Okay, so these topological invariants in the integer quantum Hall effect, you can compute from the energy band. So you can do a band structure computation to understand the electronic structure. And from the geometry of the band, you can assign this integer number and compute it. So in principle, all of this is well understood, and we don't need a quantum simulation experiment to necessarily do that, although it might still be fun. But what is remarkable is that if we add interactions to the system, there are new phases of matter that lead to fractional values of these plateaus. So now it's not an integer anymore. They appear 2/3, 3/5, 4/7, for instance. And it's unclear for many of those what exactly the nature of the many-body phase is. And this is a very difficult problem just because these phases emerge intrinsically due to interactions between the particles. So it's not easy to find an approximate way to describe those. You have to solve an interacting many-body system from the very beginning. And so it would be very nice to have a quantum simulation experiment to do these kinds of physics. Okay, so now I've spent quite some time talking about these Hall bar geometries, but of course it's not so easy to just do that in the lab, because we have a system that looks completely different. We have these charge-neutral atoms that move in this periodic potential that we generate by laser beams. And so we cannot simply recreate the physics we see here, because if we apply a magnetic field, there's no Lorentz force and no Hall deflection. We see shifts in the internal states, but we cannot simply recreate something like that in the lab. And so there are different ways of doing this. And being here, I just have to show this slide, I was actually also introduced to this topic, I think, by many lectures that I heard from Jean and other people, and it was just fascinating for me to even think about this idea. And I'm still fascinated and excited about this topic. So what you see here is a little bit, it takes me a while to explain, I think, but the basic idea is that if you have a Coriolis force in the system, if you start rotating a superfluid, the Coriolis force is mathematically equivalent to the Lorentz force. So you can use it to mimic artificial magnetic fields, and the way it shows up in these superfluids is as these vortices, these beautiful vortex lines that appear in the superfluid or the condensate. There are other more abstract ways to implement artificial magnetic fields, and this goes back to the idea of engineering geometric phases or Aharonov-Ohm phases, as I will make use of in a second as well. So a Aharonov-Ohm phase is a concept or is a phase that develops if you have an electronic system or electronic wave packet and you build an interferometer whose area is pierced by a magnetic flux or magnetic field. If you read out the phase at the end of your interferometer, it is proportional to the flux that pierces the area of the unit cell. And you can look at this as a geometric phase. This concept can be engineered in many different ways. So this idea that you have a geometric phase or a Aharonov-Ohm phase for your interferometer can then be, if you generate it with any other way here in, by dressing internal states with laser beams, interpreted as having an artificial magnetic field. So if we put this on a lattice, it looks very similar as this continuum example of the Aharonov-Ohm phase. In this case, we now look at this two-dimensional square lattice as we had before, where atoms can hop between neighboring sides of the lattice. And if I think now about having a magnetic field present, then what I find is that these hopping matrix elements become complex. And this is essentially a discretized version of this Aharonov-Ohm phase that I have in my interferometer around a closed loop. If I look at these complex hopping matrix elements and compute the equivalent, like a phase around a plaquette in the lattice, if that's non-zero, the effect is essentially like a magnetic field or magnetic flux that pierces the unit cell of the lattice. That's the basic idea. So in order to actually realize artificial magnetic fields in a lattice geometry, all you have to do is make these hopping terms complex. And now because you're imprinting them by hand, this is how you can get access to the Hofstadter butterfly, which appears at ridiculously large magnetic fields if you just have a normal solid state device at like a few thousand Teslas. You can do that because you can pick any phase between 0 and 2 pi to engineer by hand if you're using this concept of complex phases that you attach to your hopping matrix element. And without going through the details, we use Floquet engineering that is periodic driving of our Hamiltonian in order to realize these phases. So the idea is that if you just very, very quickly modulate your Hamiltonian parameters, the atoms see an effective time average system that has new properties, and in this case, it has these complex phases. Okay, so going back to the quantum Hall system, let's just assume now I know how to do this. How do you convince yourself that you have actually engineered such an artificial magnetic field? And the first experiment that you might want to do, and I'm showing this also because there's a beautiful realization here from Collège de France, is you could think about seeing cyclotron orbits, right? You could try to recreate these cyclic orbits that you would expect from an electron that moves in the presence of a magnetic field with charged neutral atoms. So this is the pictorial diagram. So you have a charged electron, and in a magnetic field, it performs these orbits. And now you could hope to see that with charged neutral atoms. And now my example is very, very old. You will see in a bit a more recent one. But so in principle, what you can track is like the real space motion of such a particle. And indeed, you see this charged neutral particle moves around a certain orbit. This does not look very beautiful. It's again like a very tiny discretized plaquette of four sides. So I wanted to show you these nice cyclotron orbits, which have been realized in a slightly different geometry, similar idea, but in synthetic dimensions. This is realized with dysprosium, and this has been done at Collège de France here in synthetic space. So this is to illustrate that these techniques really work. We can recreate or mimic the physics of charged particles in a magnetic field. And indeed, we can also see something like a Hall deflection, as you would do in a solid state device, where you can measure these transverse and longitudinal voltages and see or measure the churn number in such a device. Okay, so how does this actually look like? So our system is completely different, of course. So we use our ultra-cold atoms that we prepare in the lattice. We load it into one band of this periodic potential in the lowest band, which now has a non-zero Chern number. And then we apply a force. And what happens in this system where we apply a force by applying a tilt to our optical lattice is that if it's coherent, there's no net motion. So the atoms don't roll down the hill. We just apply this potential energy difference, which induces Bloch oscillations in our system. And then in the presence of the artificial magnetic field, what you see if you take pictures of that cloud is they start to move to the side. And this sideways motion, if you prepare it for a system where the complete lowest band is filled, so this is a bit like electrons with a Fermi energy in the band gap that occupy like one electronic band, the response that you get in this transverse motion is proportional to the topological invariant or the Chern number that characterizes that band, which in our case is a Chern number that is equal to one. So if you just track with pictures the sideways motion, you get this nice linear behavior, and from this we can fit a value which is in agreement with what you expect from theory. And this is quite remarkable, I would say, because what we have done here is to realize this integer quantum Hall system with atoms that do not have any charge, and even more so in this case, it's bosons. It's not even anything like the electronic system that we started out with. Okay, so now all this is integer quantum Hall physics, so there are no interactions. And so the last remaining 10 minutes or so, I wanted to spend on telling you on where we are in terms of making many-body systems out of that. And so the state of the art for the moment is still two interacting particles for doing strongly correlated physics in these systems where we can see and manipulate each individual atom. So this is an example from Markus Greiner's group in Harvard, where they have used two bosonic atoms to realize fractional quantum Hall type state, like it's a Laughlin wave function that occurs at filling 1/2 that has been realized in the system. So it's two particles on 16 lattice sites. There's another example from Selim Jochim's group where the idea is based on rotation. So this goes back to this idea of the Lorentz force being mathematically equivalent to the Coriolis force. And here they have engineered a two-particle wave function, also Laughlin state wave function with fermionic atoms. And there are other examples from photonic platforms, superconducting qubits and polaritons. Again, also two particles. So this is essentially where we are and what we can do. And like I cannot show you now a many-body fractional quantum Hall state, but what we have been trying to do is go ahead and find a stable parameter regime where we can put many interacting particles in our system and look for the ground state properties, study the phase diagram of an interacting many-body system in the presence of these artificial magnetic fields. And the system that we have picked in our case is a simplified geometry. It's not a fully coupled two-dimensional lattice, but it is an array of ladder systems. So you should think about these as two coupled chains. So we have a tunnel coupling along this direction, and we have a perpendicular rung coupling with amplitude k that is also complex. So this one has like a phase that increases linearly as a function of distance and gives rise to these Aharonov-Bohm phases or artificial magnetic fields that pierce the unit cell of such a ladder. And these yellow blobs, essentially what they illustrate is that we use the technique of measuring local currents in order to detect the properties of this state. Okay. So now let me first motivate why the physics in this system is actually quite interesting. And I will walk you through the phase diagram first without interactions. So just purely non-interacting particles in a ladder with flux. And this is something that we have worked on together with Thierry already like a while back in like also during my PhD. And now we do many-body physics in that system. Okay, so what do you see here? On the horizontal axis, you see the magnitude of the magnetic flux that we apply to the ladder. And on the vertical axis, you see the ratio of the two coupling strings, the rung over the leg coupling. And now there are different phases in that system that we labeled as Meissner phase and vortex phase. And JC is the chiral current. So this is illustrated by these blue arrows. The chiral current is defined as the sum of the current pointing up and down on the other side. So it's really like a circulating current around the edges of the system. So if you want, you can think about this as like a minimal system that has a bulk and an edge. The bulk is fairly small. It only has the rung couplings. And the edge is defined by the legs that have these circulating currents. And so what is interesting is that if you look at a fixed value of the rung over leg coupling, so along this red dashed line, and you look at the strength of the chiral current as a function of the applied flux, you find a behavior that is reminiscent of type 2 superconductors. You look at the chiral current, or this shielding current, as a function of the applied field, and you find that it follows it roughly linearly. So the stronger the flux that you apply, the stronger this circulating current around the edges, which tries to prevent the flux from penetrating the bulk of your type 2 superconductor until you reach a critical value. And so this is what we label the Meissner phase. It has a homogeneous density that is shown in gray, and it has these chiral currents. So this is a plot of the ground state wave function that you can calculate in that system. And then as you hit the critical value of the flux and go beyond, the fluxes start to enter the bulk of your system, and this circular loop starts to break up into smaller vortex currents. And this is what is labeled as the vortex phase. And now, this is a particularly good example where it would be very nice to just locally be able to study the current distribution in a microscope experiment. And as it turns out, bosonic flux ladders, or flux ladders in general, are actually very well suited to try and go to many interacting particles. This is again an example from Markus Greiner's group, where they studied it with two particles in a quench experiment. I don't know what I just did. Okay. And there's another set of examples actually from Leo Falani's group in Italy at Lens, where they studied interacting fermions in that system. Not in a microscope, but it's a very nice minimal quasi 1D system that allows you to study Lorentz force type behavior, orbital magnetism, or Hall currents in the first place. Okay, so now we do the same thing, well, similar. We have bosons strongly interacting in our lattice. And if you go to the strongly interacting regime, so now we make the interaction so strong that particles essentially cannot hop on top of each other. They prevent this from happening. We find insulating phases at half filling that still have these circular currents, or the structure that I've explained in the beginning. And we have prepared like an adiabatic protocol to ramp into the ground state, for instance, of this Meissner phase, and then detected the local current distribution. And this is an actual experimental result from our experiment, where we show the distribution of this measured local current. Here we did a measurement on every other bond. So that these ones are empty doesn't mean there's no current. This is just we didn't look at these bonds. So you see these nice blue arrows which point to the left on the lower leg and to the right on the upper leg. And we also measured the currents on the rungs. And you see that they are very, very faint, which essentially encodes the amplitude of that current. And it just means there's essentially no current in the bulk. So we see this nice circulating current in the Meissner phase. We can measure the density. And as expected, there's no information in the density. This is resolved for the current on the upper leg, the lower leg, and in the bulk, which is the structure that you would expect from the Meissner phase. And this is then, for the first time, actually a measurement where we're able to realize such a strongly interacting system in the presence of a magnetic flux. And we have tuned it across the critical value of the rung-to-leg coupling from the Mott-Meissner to the Mott-Vortex phase to also see the reduction of the chiral current in the vortex phase. Seeing the actual vortex structure locally is extremely challenging. We have spent a lot of time trying to see it. You can see that the many-body gap is very small in this region, so it typically has a higher temperature compared to the Meissner phase. So we did not yet resolve the local structure of the vortices, but we managed to get fairly low in temperature And to give you a sense, so now we are at 24 interacting particles, which is still a very small number. But if you want to be positive, it's an order of magnitude more than two. So that's good. And the temperatures are relatively low for this periodically driven system. It's on the order of the tunnel coupling. And maybe to give you a sense of what do we need to achieve to see fractional quantum Hall states or like large-scale fractional quantum Hall states, we would need to lower this to about 0.1. So it's like close, we are not there yet, but it's a very nice step towards achieving this limit. And yeah, I think this is a good point to stop. There's a lot more that I could show you about edge states and anomalous Fluke, but I think this is a good point to thank my team, and in particular, the people that worked on the cesium quantum gas microscope. Alex did an amazing job on the flux ladder and the current measurements. And I also wanted to highlight Simon. I didn't talk about his work, but we recently had results on generating quantum spin liquids, which is also an interesting topic. And the other team I wanted to mention as well, because they have worked on Haldane phases, anomalous Fluke, topological edge states, which are other interesting facets of topology that we can look at in our system. So thank you very much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.